Ow, a silver earring. No, not really. Well, did you enjoy your break? Good, good. I had the pleasure of talking to a few people, you know, and I said this last night, and I certainly want to say it this morning. I don't assume that I'm an expert on anything. I'm not an expert on the Big Book. I'm not an expert on AA. I'm not an expert on God. I'm just here sharing my experience, strength, and hope with what works for me. And that's so important, you know. And I was thinking at the break there, you know, the third step is we got to turn the lives of those loved ones over too, and God's will for them, and our will for them. It's not just, you know, it's not just our will in life, but it really has to be anybody we really care about has to be, if we want them to be free and if we want to be free. Because how are we going to be free if we still insist on controlling everybody else's lives around us, you know? It's funny, on step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Searching and fearless means just that. It doesn't mean, I've heard some people say in a general way, when it says in the book that we illuminate every nook and cranny, that's not a general way to me. To me, it means that in this inventory, I am going to write down my deepest of darkest secrets. Now, I understand that the other 12-step programs, people do it a little differently. Again, I'm reverting back to the original text. In my understanding of those 12 steps, I do not find any good purpose in writing down good things at this part of the steps. For me, here's why. I always justified my actions. If you want me to write down the good and the bad in an inventory, I'm going to have you convinced that there was no other way for me to do it. It was the only right thing to do. Because that's the way my mind works. It was very important for me to take out the garbage. And that's what the fourth step is about. And, you know, we are garbage collectors. We just are. I don't know of any other group of people that starts feeling good, and when they start feeling good, they'll pick up their old garbage and smell it for a while. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, now I remember. Thanks very much. And they'll go to meetings, and they'll work the steps, and they'll help people, and then all of a sudden, and we do it with all, well, what happened when I was a kid? What happened when I was adult? What happened in my first marriage? What happened in my second marriage? What happened? You know, one of the things that I had to do in the fourth step, too, and I help my people do, is decide what's true. What's true? Because my first fourth step, you would have thought that if I hadn't done that, I would have been bad, you know? Because I had no guidelines like the Big Book or a sponsor's input. And I think it's very important for me in this writing this inventory to put down everything I really think. There is no right or wrong here. And I put down, now I'm not talking about eight. When people get up to, I had 120 pages, I'd say you're a bit self-obsessed. You know? You're just a bit self-obsessed then. I don't know that 120 pages, maybe it is needed for some people, but I don't know that. But I know that it has to be thorough, and it has to be the things I don't want to talk about. Those are the major things. And for me, it wasn't big, major things. For instance, when I was in county jail one time, there were some guys that got, was rare then, it's pretty common now, they got picked up for having explosives. They were going to blow something up. And so we decided in county jail that night that we were going to hold court. It's called kangaroo court. We held court, and this guy's brother threw him on the mercy of the court. I guess there were some family problems. And I was the prosecutor. I beat that guy almost to death. It was about 110, 115 in the tank that weekend, and I kept running him around that tank and smacking him as hard as I could every time he came around. And I kept it up, and I kept it up, and I kept it up. It was one problem. Before that, I'd always tell you, I was drinking. I'd been in there about 30 days at that point. I was stark raving sober. Now that's bad. Didn't bother me near as much as the look on my mother's face when I broke her heart one more time. Didn't bother me near as much. So this inventory is for me to get out the reality of what bothers me. And most of my inventory was the nickel and dime compromises, not the podium stuff. You know, but I stole money out of my mother's purse. You know? I never put any in. Always took some out. And one of the things that was on my inventory that I swore I'd never tell anybody is Little Eva had a song some years ago called Locomotion. And we had a record player, and we'd play that 45. How you just play that one riff over and over, and you just play it and play it all day long and all day long. And my buddy and I loved this song. And one day I stole the record. I don't even have a record player. But I stole the record. And the next day I went to my buddy's house, and he said, I wonder where that record is. And I said, I don't know. That bothered me worse than beating the guy. I can't explain it. It's just the way it is. That bothered me worse than beating the guy. That bothered me worse than the look on my mother's face. So for me, this inventory was very important that I put down what... It doesn't have to make sense to you. It's what bothered me. The rights and wrongs that I had done. The nickel and dime compromises. Through doing step four and writing it out, and I must say I've done an inventory a number of different ways. I'm one of those that believe that I need to do one every 5-6 years. Here's why for me. I'm not excellent on step 10. I'm pretty good, but I'm nowhere near perfect. And the longer I'm sober, things slip through the cracks on step 10. And so I know once every 5-6 years, I'm going to sit down and clean out the cracks. So I do that inventory, and I've done it a number of different ways, as the text says it. There's a guy in Chicago sober 52 years, and everybody exchanges fifth steps with each other, and that seems to work well. And there's a lot of things. I've done it a lot of ways, but one thing that's remained consistent is I've always grown as a result of taking an inventory. I am not one that thinks you should write about everything in your life. I think that's just another form of chronic self-obsession. Me, 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 me. People that I sponsor don't journal. Do you know why they don't journal? Because if they end up with a few bad days, they'll end up with a depression, and they'll increase it with each day they write. So I say to them, if you're going to journal, there's one condition. Only the good things. Only the things to be grateful for, only the good things that are going to lift you up. That's what you journal. Because I don't know about you, but my life kind of went like this. Oh, life's wonderful, life's wonderful. I'm having a great day today. Life sucks, and they're looking at me funny, and I'm tired of this job. And oh, man, isn't it great? And when I start writing the greats, the lower dip seems to disappear. Because that's where my focus is. I am focused on being negative. I have a gift. If there's something that can be found wrong, I'll find it and share it with you. It's that 299 one again, where I walk into a room with 300 people, 299, you're the best one, says, jerk. It's another thing I had to put in my inventory, that I will look for reasons to stay sick. I will look at anything in the worst possible scenario to justify any actions I want to take. I remember one time there was a guy, he was sober 18 years. Well, I found out later he wasn't really sober 18 years. But to my understanding, he was sober 18 years, and he drank. And I made a 12-step call on him with an old-timer. We walked into his house, and he totally justified drinking after an extended period of time, because his wife referred to their house as her house. You laugh, but that's our insanity. That's why it's so important to change the way we view things. And the only way you're really going to know how you view things and how you look at things is what you write. Honestly. When we get into step five, it was funny, when I was going through seminary, I was trying to be a good guy, just another pastor going through seminary. And they brought in this guy, nice Catholic priest, seemed to be a nice guy. And he was giving us a lecture on how to do a fifth step. And I'm listening, and he said, now when you listen to a fifth step, you don't say anything. You just let that person relieve themselves of whatever's going on. In my hand, kind of. I said, now, where'd you get that information? He said, I've been sober 18 years. I said, yeah, I've been sober 25. Where'd you get that information? Well, I've been trained. I said, by who? And I sent him a portion of the 12 and 12 where it says in the fifth step, we counsel, direct, and advise. For those who say we don't give advice. We counsel, direct, and advise in the fifth step. Otherwise, I am leaving with the same ideas I came in with. Otherwise, I'm going to be leaving with the same, and that explained why my first fifth step failed so badly. I went in there, I was at a retreat, they tricked me into going to a retreat where God lives. It was one of them monasteries, and it's kind of scary if you ask me. And it's Friday night, Big John knocks on the door and says, Ed, yeah. He said, Father Dan will be waiting for you to take your fifth step in the morning. I said, I haven't even written my fourth. He said, oh, better get to work, he's expecting me at 6. You know, I'm an atheist, but I ain't taking no chances, you know. And I wrote it, and I went down there, and Father Dan is a wonderful guy. He's listened to fifth steps, thousands of fifth steps, hundreds anyway. And the next day I was creating a new fourth step. I thought, well, what was that? What good was that for? See, the reason I have to be honest in my fourth step is so people can give me a new way to look at things. So I don't have to live that way anymore. I have permission to share this. I was just doing a fifth step 2 weeks ago. I won't tell you his name, certainly, or her name, whoever it might be. but one of the things in his inventory was he felt really horrible that he had ripped this person off for $2,300. He'd ripped this person off for $2,300, and he just felt terrible about that. A little later in his inventory, we were talking about resentments, and he said, this one guy stole all my tools, all of them. I said, wow, were there a lot of tools? He said, I spent $1,000 and don't even have them half replaced. So I said, oh, so when you get all done, it'll be about $2,300, you think? And he's the one that's been slipping for 26 years. And his face turned red, and he started to laugh, and I knew he got it. I knew he got it. We're so easy to hold you responsible for what you did and not holding us responsible for what we did. And he left with a little better attitude than that. But thank God he put it in the inventory. Thank God he put down, had the courage enough to put down. And you know what I think is bad? This usually comes a different part, but God, it keeps coming to mind now, so I'm going to share it with you. I had a guy come in to me and said, Ed, I really need to talk to you. God, not an alcoholic, if my memory serves me correctly. But he said, I need to come in and talk to you. He said, I just hate my father. I've hated him for years. And it just is eating me alive. He said, can I come in and talk to you? And I said, sure. And he came in and, he's uptight. And he's just, and this is a real dapper together guy. This is a guy who's had the best, you know, and knows the best and of what people call the best anyway. And I'm kind of braced for the worst story I've ever heard. And I said, well, I said, you're here to talk about your father. And he said, yeah, I am. I said, well, share with me what the problem. He said, on my 14th birthday, my father gave me a baseball glove. And he gave my brother the very same one that day. Yeah? That was it. He had hated his father all those years. And I said, who paid for your education? He said, my father. I said, where'd you go to school? It's one of the Ivy League schools. I said, was he never there for you? Oh, he was there for us all the time. And I we started talking about the positive things. And after an hour or so, he said, "Well, that really doesn't make sense, does it, Ed?" I said, "No." But he had to come to that conclusion. I helped him, push him along a little bit. And you know what? He's had a wonderful relationship with his father ever since. But if he had not stopped to take that little inventory, and he was, in his mind, he was totally justified that he hated his father so bad. How could he do that? You know what? I've done the same thing, I'm sure, and can still do the same thing, I'm sure. It's called blowing things out of proportion. That's another thing that inventories are very good for. I could always, in my inventory, I would tell you that my first day of school, Miss Kasich, not that I remember her, in kindergarten slapped me across the face. And I hated school ever since. Upon inventory, I realized I didn't tell you about Miss Burns and Miss Vanderslice and Mr. Stofers, who were wonderful teachers, who tried everything in their power to help me. You see, I do the 299 to 1 with that, too. I'd look at the worst, in the worst possible way, to justify my misery, to justify my actions. It's like I shared with you, I believe I shared with you last night, I wrote down that my parents abused me. That Dad would take out that belt and beat me, and sometimes beat me with his fist. I remember the day I got kicked out of school at age 13, and they didn't just kick me out of school, they kicked me out of two states of schools. They wouldn't let me in school in Iowa or Illinois. And I came home and I walked in the door and Dad was there. He said, "What are you doing home early?" I said, "Well, I got kicked out of school." He said, "Well, get back there." I said, "They said I can't come back and I can't go to Iowa. I can't go to school anywhere." And he started beating on me. And he got done and I said, "Are you finished?" Tears came to his eyes and I thought, I broke him. You bet I did. I broke his heart. He was doing whatever he could to keep his baby boy on the right track. And oh, by today's standards, it wasn't the right thing to do, but it's what he was taught. That you overpower them and you discipline them. And through those experiences is where I learned that I was a parent abuser. I was never abused. Never abused. I pushed them to the breaking point time and time and time again. I did it with authority. I did it with everybody. I was the abuser. And then I'd blame you. I'd push you till you'd break, and then I'd go, "See? And she made me do it." Inventories are very important. Inventories are very important because when you get into the fifth step, hopefully you're going to be with somebody who helps you decipher the truth. That's what my understanding of the fifth step is about. To sift it out, not to rubber stamp your own inadequacies and fears, most of which are not true in my experience. Chuck Chamberlain used to say something. He said, "I found when I came to AA, the only thing I haven't changed in my life is the understanding of the multiplication tables." That's true for me. Everything I've ever believed has been challenged when I'm willingly participating in my own recovery. How can they not be? I've heard people say, "Oh, I can't take an inventory. I'm too bad." Oh, get over yourself. I've had people say to me, "You know, I'm the worst person I've ever known." I said, "You're worse than Charlie Manson?" And they go, "Oh, no, I'm not that bad." I said, "Oh, just trying to get the story right here. Did you know about him?" "Yeah." "Oh, okay." It's the way we think about things. There is no one in this room that committed an original sin, I promise you. They've all been done before and probably much better, you know? So when we talk about a four-step, we're not talking about embarrassing you. We're talking about removing the splinter so you can heal, or the splinters, whatever the case may be. But if we don't get in there and if we don't remove that splinter, the healing cannot take place. Oh, I know there's people. I've known people in AA. "I've been sober 25 years. I've never taken a four-step." I said, "Yeah, I can tell." You know? And if that's what you want, more power to you. If that's what you want, more power to you. That's just not what I want. You know, I wanted the dis-ease to go away. And one of the most effective ways for me to do that is to actually practice the steps. And understand that thinking I'm the worst that ever was is ego too. I mean, think about it. You're the worst? Really? What arrogance. What arrogance. You know what I found out? I'm at best average. I'm at best an average drunk. With all the things I've done, I'm at best average. And it's one of the few times I enjoy being average. You know? So when you're sitting, and if you haven't done this fourth step, I would urge you to. Because I believe that if you don't do a fourth step, fourth and fifth step, you have an excellent chance of drinking, but I'll add something to that. You have an increased chance of drinking if you don't follow it up with the rest of the steps, especially 8 and 9, because that's the ending of the process of what we've begun in 4 and 5. You know, it's like making a cake and not putting it in the oven. Don't be surprised if it's all soupy, you know? If you don't put it in to bake it, it ain't going to happen. And the 12 steps for me are exactly what I read this morning. It gives us a way to find a personal relationship with a God that'll solve our problems. Any problem. Any problem. Any problem I've ever put to the test has been solved. Any problem. The fourth step, a lot of it in there, was ego and pride. We'll talk about that later. You know, it's funny, when I first come to AA and when I first started participating in the 12 steps, we used to have a lot of meetings on smashing the ego. Now we have meetings everywhere building self-esteem. I'd rather eliminate the ego and build my God esteem. Because if I'm believing God's in me, God be in you. So it lifts all of us. It ain't about me. My troubles before I came here, it was all about me. And again, I've heard Al-Anon say, no, I did everything for everybody else. Well, I was making it all about you. That's the control. And it was all about me. And in that fourth step is where it makes it clear, really, where it's all about me. And how I had most of it terribly, terribly wrong. Terribly wrong. So, in an inventory, I'd suggest you take it. If you're newer, if you're used, I suggest you take it. Especially if you've been around for a while, if you're in those spots in sobriety where kind of the shininess is rubbed off your sober trophy, I would suggest that you might go get it recovered, you know, and with the 12 steps. Because one of the things I need to tell you is every time I read that book, it's changed. Every time I read, that's impossible. But that's my experience. First time I read that big book, God was not mentioned once. God fairy creeped into my room, snuck in, and eventually put him in about every paragraph. My old friend Chuck C. used to say, you can't see till you can see, and you can't hear till you can hear. But you got to keep showing up till you can see, until you can hear. And the more I practice these steps, the more I see and the more I hear. It isn't an intellectual discipline. It's a spiritual discipline. And if I'm not willing to take out the garbage, what do I have left to smell? Garbage. Garbage. Every once in a while they do a special on hoarders where they hoard everything. And I think, man, I was like that with every negative thing in my life. They hoard for a different reason, but I compared it to, that's how my heart and my soul was, and I couldn't tell you why sometimes I'd just explode into a million pieces. Because I hoarded all that stuff. And now there's things that want you to go over and over and over and over that stuff before you even know if it's the truth. Talk about wasted time. I remember when I was in that insane asylum, They wanted to talk to me about my parents. They wanted to talk to me about my mother. And my brother Chuck spent a lot of time in prison. He used to go in and they had the psychiatrist there and they'd say, "How are you feeling today, Chuck?" And he said, "Oh, I've hated my dad. Always hated my dad. He was horrible. He abused us." Next time he come in and said, "How are you feeling about your dad?" He said, "Oh, I love my dad, hate my mom. She was horrible. She just didn't." Next time come in, "Well, how are you feeling about your mom and dad?" "I love my mom and dad. It's my brother." And he said, "There's nothing wrong with you." He said, "Thank you very much," and got up and walked out. We can play all the mind games we want, but no healing takes place until we honestly participate. And how can we honestly participate if we don't know what the truth is? It's not their fault that they aren't that much help. It's our fault because we don't know the deal. And the deal is rigorous self-honesty. The deal is, if I can't get honest with myself and have a little help doing that with sponsorship in these steps, and eventually a God of my own understanding, I don't have any hope. I don't have any hope. So in this inventory, it's setting you up, in my understanding, to give you, armed with the proper facts about ourselves. Not the myths, the facts. Because see, that's what this part is about, getting to the facts, not the myths. We're full of the myths. That's why we keep drinking, that's why we keep enabling, that's why we keep controlling. We know the myths. What we don't know is the truth, the facts. And for me in my inventory, I realized that I was the big part of it. In what I was reading there about selfishness, self-centeredness, I just want to go back for a minute, because this is the premise that we should be on. It says our selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles on page 62. And it says, so our troubles are basically of our own making. The last paragraph is what I want to focus on. It's regressing a little bit, but I think it's important at this point. It says, this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. Notice it doesn't say a little powerful. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. And the book is full of ifs, if you haven't heard them. Here's one. If we kept close to him and performed his work well. If you're wondering why you're not experiencing God in your life, I got a question for you. How are you doing his will and performing it in your life? Established on such footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Now, this isn't scripture, this is the big book. And reborn, what they mean is new life. I'm not trading in something, I'm starting something. And that fourth step, the third and fourth step, is the gateway to that freedom. But here's the next line that really stopped me cold. The next line is, we are now at step 3. You know what that infers? That we had a full understanding of that selfishness, self-centeredness, he is the director, we are his agents, before we moved on to step 3. Scary, isn't it? I thought, well, golly gee, I got down on my knees and I said that. Isn't that enough? No. No. I've got to be, because if I'm not understanding this, the selfishness, self-centeredness, what are we writing on our inventory? It's all based in the stuff we've just read here. Then we make the preparation to get a God of our understanding. We made a decision to turn our will and our life, and then we're going to take out the garbage. What's the garbage? It's listed here for you. Selfishness, self-centeredness. That's the root. And resentment. And as we go through the inventory, it lists more. But I have to be willing to get rid of the garbage. And it's tough for a lot of us because the garbage has become our identity. One of my biggest things was anger. And it had become part of my identity. I used to quietly think, if I let go of all that anger and rage, what am I going to be? A nothing? If I let go of all that anger and rage, what's going to replace it? It's called peace. Who knew? I didn't because I'd never experienced it before. But I had to be willing to let it go in step three and write about it in step four. I had one of those tempers that every once in a while I run into people, have it. It's called a rage. You know, conversely to a blackout, we'll call it a whiteout because there was no alcohol involved. And I wouldn't have hurt you a minute before and I wouldn't have hurt you a minute after, but in that 1 minute in between, I'm going to say things that I'll regret the rest of my life. Somebody left their phone on. Don't know who it'd be. Wait a minute, I feel a message coming in. Oh, that's funny. I could have swore I turned that off. I guess I didn't. There's a lesson for you. Now, see, there would have been a day when I would swear I didn't hear the announcement, but today I know I did, see. That's the difference. What was I talking about? Anybody know? The rage, thank you. And it was deep within me. And eventually you'd see that rage and eventually you'd leave. So it's better to drink because sometimes you can drink right through the rage and not remember. Or you can see the destruction. Now when you get sober and if you don't understand three and four, guess what you get to keep? The rage. I was down in Bowling Green, Kentucky, about 4 years ago. Guy walked up to me and said, "Ed, how are you?" And I said, "Oh, good. How are you?" And it's a guy that used to go to meetings in L.A. when I was out there. He said, "You know, I remember going to meetings with you in L.A." He said, "I specifically remember the last meeting." And I said, "Really? Why is that?" And he said, "You knocked a guy out with one punch." And I went, "Shh, I'm a spiritual guru now. Shh, then." And I did. Let me tell you a story. I have a justification. We're sitting in the meeting, and the culture of this meeting is there's nobody talking during the participation. When somebody's up, you pay respect. You don't get up. You don't wander around. You just... And we got this guy in front, and he's behind, nah, 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 during the participation. I tap him on the shoulder. I said, "Can you please hold it down? I'm trying to hear. I can't hear the speaker." And he said, "Oh, okay." And we had a coffee break. It was out in West Coast. All the meetings are an hour and a half, which I prefer, by the way. And you do a half hour, and then you get a 10-minute coffee break, and then you do the rest of that hour and a half. And at the coffee break, he turned around and said, "Don't you tell me to shut up." And at that time, I was processing my anger. Breathing in and... breathing out. Breathing in and breathing out. Serenity now. And I reasoned with him. I said, "No, you don't understand the culture of this group." Little Alice knew me a lot better. She got up and said, "Big Ed, sit down. Big Ed, sit down." I said, "Oh, honey, don't worry. I'm handling this just fine." She went away and I went back to talking with my friend. And here's Alice again, 5 more minutes. "Big Ed, sit down. Big Ed, sit down." I said, "Oh, honey, don't worry." And I turned around and he said, "Don't you ever..." And pop! He's flying over 4 rows of chairs. My program immediately kicked in. And I went around and woke him up and promptly admitted I was wrong. And I sponsored him for the next 5 years. You see, he had been a slipper, and he said nobody had ever gotten his attention before. So. Now, the goodness that come out of that is God's grace, I believe. But what I need to tell you is it broke my heart because I always said I would never lay a hand on anybody in AA. I'm 15 years sober. Just knocked the guy out in a meeting. Going to plenty of meetings, thank you very much. Sponsoring a lot of people. Speaking a lot, yeah. How you doing? Fine, why? I'm going out to Thousand Oaks, California, going to give a spiritual talk, I'm sure. This guy cuts me off on the freeway, and road rage in California was my recreation. And this guy in a silver Audi, I don't know why I remember silver Audi, but I remember, he cut me off, slammed on his brakes, and flipped me off. And then he did my favorite gesture. He went, pull over, and I thought, excellent, let's do that. He pulled over, and he got out of his car, and he started running for me, and I thought, oh, there's my cue. Get out of the car, unfold, and his eyes get this big. And I grab him by his little crotch in his collar, and I throw him over his car. Immediately, my program kicked in, and I, you know, this really isn't a good thing to be doing, Ed. I went around, and I picked him up, and I brushed him off, and I set him in the car, and I said, you know, I'm a member of a 12-step program, and as soon as we do something wrong, he's a took off. And I was heartsick. Remember I talked to you last night or this morning about you're the only reflection of a program anybody would ever see? And I was being a horrible example, and I couldn't figure it out. Shortly after that, I was working in a place in Burbank, California. I was the sales manager, and this woman came in to get a refund on a deposit she'd left. For some reason, it had never came through. And it was a product that would move quickly, and I'd just taken over the place, and I said, well, I'll be happy to give you your deposit. Sorry it hasn't worked out, but I'm looking at the deal they had worked out. I can make a lot more money on it, so I don't. Here's your money. She came in, I gave her the check, and her boyfriend's with her, flexing, in Southern California. And I said, hi, how are you? He said, what are you, some sort of faggot? I said, excuse me. He said, you think you're tough? And I had a coffee cup in my hand, and I crushed it. A glass coffee cup. And I thought I'd help him out the door. And he started running, and I started running right after him, and I'm going down Burbank, California, Burbank Boulevard in Burbank, California, mad dashing after what I found out was a lion tamer and a stuntman. And my new owner is driving down the street, and I'm going, ugh. I get back. I had been there about 3 months, and everybody loved me. Really had a good time. I go back into this place, and nobody'd even look me in the eye. That's the kind of rage I had. I quit shortly afterwards because I'd ruined it. I had a horrible temper. I say had because I had to do a third step and surrender my right to be angry at anything. At anything. I had to quit playing the intellectual game of it's okay for me to process this. It says in the big book that anger is the dubious luxury of normal men and women. It certainly is one I cannot afford. Now, how do you surrender that? You just surrender it as soon as it comes. How do you surrender it? You just surrender it. You don't work through it. It's not that ego that somehow we got to control the process. That's not turning your will and your life over to God. It's turning your will and your life over to you. That's what created the problem in the first place. The reality is the surrender. The reality in steps 3 and 4 is we must surrender all this stuff if we really want to get better. Now, the problem is therein. There's some that really don't want to get better. Just want to get the wife off the back, the boss off the back, the husband off the back. You know, 12-step programs, you can come here and simulate recovery for years on end and not do a thing. But that isn't the kind of program I'm interested in anymore. I want to be involved with the program that I actually recover. I remember Clancy one time said, there was this guy at Beverly Hills, he was at a men's stag, and this guy in Beverly Hills was speaking, and he said, "All anger has left me. I never have a bad thought or a bad feeling. I never get outraged." And Clancy thought, if this guy's telling the truth, I'm in real trouble. So Clancy's pouring coffee afterwards. And the guy sitting there, Clancy pours coffee in his lap. He said, "I'm pleased to tell you all his anger and rage returned." But you see, that's one extreme to the other. When it comes, what I got to do is surrender it, not work through it, not process it. If I'm working with you, or if I'm sponsoring you, if I'm life coaching you, if I'm doing it, two words you don't use with me: I'm trying or I'm working on it. Don't waste my time. All that means, or I'm in the process. All that means is you're not ready to make a commitment. Call me when you're ready to make a commitment, and we'll move forward. All that mental stuff we get into. Dr. Bob's last talk in Cleveland, Ohio, 1950. This is a paraphrase, and I hope I don't mangle it too bad. But he was very ill, and he got up and he said something to me that's more profound today than he said it in 1950. He said, "Let's keep this thing simple. Let's not louse this thing up with Freudian complexities. What may be of interest to the medical or scientific mind has little or nothing to do with our actual AA work." Got to get back to the surrender, not the processing. Breathing in, breathing out. Now later on, I love meditation and I breathe in and out. And it's a wonderful thing to do, especially for most people who love addicted people or addicted people, because one thing I've noticed is we're shallow breathers. It's true. Absolutely true. That's why we'll go, "What are you doing?" Now, and the minute we get tense. And I picked that up by a friend of mine, Clint H. I don't know if you've ever heard Clint. He passed away last year, and he was my buddy. He saved my life. Just a quick story about Clint, left in his memory. I walked into a meeting. Clint says, "How are you, Ed?" And I said, "Well, job's terrible. Wife, I hate the wife. I don't like the wife. Everything's terrible. They're looking at me funny at work." And I go on and on and on. Clint patiently waits. And I get all done. And he said, "You know, Ed, you got to fight through a lot of happiness to be that miserable, don't you?" That's my buddy Clint, you know. And I was an expert at fighting through happiness, believe me. I have no idea where I was going after that. Clint, inventory. Have no idea where I was going after that. It'll come back around in a minute. In the fifth step, we need to get going, I think. Guess what? If I shut off my phone, I don't have a clock. It's all a plot, isn't it? In the fifth step, as I told you, I took my first fifth step with a priest, Father Dan, who I love. You know what kind of guy he is? Tell you what kind of guy this guy is. I hadn't seen Father Dan in 25 years. I'd moved, went to California, moved back, and I just went up there to the retreat one weekend to spend some quiet time, because I love retreats, and I love to be alone with God anymore. And I went up there to see him, and I got to spend some time with Father Dan one-on-one time, and I said, we were talking, and I said, "You know, Father Dan, what really touched my heart when we talked is that you said you would pray for me. And I appreciate when you did that." And he said, "What do you mean did that?" "I still do that. Every day. Every day." So please don't think that I'm saying anything bad about Father Dan. Because praying for me still 25 years later, that's a committed man. I like that. I can't wait for losing. Anybody got a watch? Bobby, can I use your watch? I get more watches this way. It really is nice. When I got me a nice one here, yeah, this worked, yeah. Thanks, Bobby. Oh, we're in good shape. And then I took my an inventory. When I got Clancy as a sponsor, he said, if I'm going to be your sponsor, you're going to take your inventory with me. And I was brought up in AA where you don't do that. You know, you just don't do that. What if they get drunk? Well, what if the priest gets drunk? You know? But it made sense to me. Well, you don't want to do that. They might get drunk, tell the whole world your problems. And I liked the monastery where they never saw daylight. That was a safe place. Unless he was a gossip. Then we got another problem. You know, but I said, okay, and I wrote that fourth step and fifth step. I wrote that fourth step, went in to do my fifth step. And he said something that kind of took me back. He said, I will probably interrupt you in your process. And he challenged almost everything I wrote down. When I have somebody doing a fourth and fifth step with me, I said, sometime in the process, you're going to get really mad at me or I ain't doing my job. Because if you go out of here believing the exact same stuff you did coming in, this didn't work. And he did. He challenged about everything. That's how I learned that I was a parent abuser. He didn't say that. But he'd say things like, you mean, Ed, you just walk into the house and your dad would start beating you? Well, no. I said, well, tell me how that came about. Well, I was 6 months sober. I was 6 months sober, and my brother that got sober, drank and died, stole my car. And I called my mother. I said, Mom, Chuck stole my car. She said, how's it feel? That Alabama ruined her, I'll tell you. And believe me, I'm totally joking, because Al-Anon saved my life in this way. When all else failed, Mom would bail me out. And I called her at 2 o'clock in the morning. She didn't even ask who it was. Picked up the phone, needed her to bail me out. She just said, nope. There was no caller ID at that time. And I talked to her after I was sober for a while, and I thanked her for that. She just cried. She said, Eddie, that was the toughest thing I've ever done in my life. I didn't want to do that, and I've second-guessed that 100 times. I said, Mom, you opened the doors to the kingdom. You didn't shut any doors. You opened one. So I really appreciate the tough work that has to be done for those we love. I have a 28-year-old son right now that's majoring in methamphetamine. And it wouldn't surprise me any day to get a call that he's dead. But that's not my business. My business is to put him into God's hands. That's my business. You know. But as we went through that fourth and fifth step, he challenged me. And I challenge people too, not to be mean, but our lives are on the line here. Our sanity, everything we hope to be or come. And once you get rid of the garbage, once you get rid of all that, some healing can come in. One of the things I challenge people to do all the time, and I start this at step 3, I said, I want you to reclaim your dreams. And people go, well, I don't have any. I said, oh, don't lie to me. You got some somewhere. They may have been when you were a kid. But I want you to reclaim your dreams right now. You have the right to them. I believe those dreams are God's gift to you, and your lack of belief is the only thing that keeps you from accomplishing them. That's been my experience. You see, when I was a kid, I used to want to travel all over the world and meet famous people. I wanted to go first class and stay in 5-star hotels. I wanted to ride in limousines and drive Mercedes, because that's where my head was at the time. And guess what I was doing at 9 years sober? Manager of the Harlem Globetrotters, traveling all over the world, meeting every celebrity I'd ever wanted to meet. Riding in limousines and 5-star hotels. You know, the reason I did that is to challenge you about that dream crap and prove you wrong. Because everybody in my neighborhood told me I was crazy. Everybody in my neighborhood said, people like you don't do things like that. Came into the AA and got around 12 steps, folks, and they say, bet you can. I bet you can. Why don't you go for it? So one of the things I do in 3, 4, and 5, at the end of 5, going into 6 and 7, I ask people to reclaim their dreams. And if you don't have one, get one. And have the courage enough. Just take one step toward it. That's all. One step toward it. In my inventory, I found out that I indeed was the creator of most of my chaos. Yes, there were some things in life that happened that I had no power over. And there were some things in life that happened that I used to my own advantage. This is a tricky subject for a lot of people, and I understand that, but I want to share it with you. Trying to figure out how to approach it. My mother was one of the best grievers I've ever known. She'd call me up and say, "Eddie, do you know what today is?" And I said, "No, Mom. It's the day Aunt June died." I said, "Mom, Aunt June died before I was born." She said, "Yeah, I just thought you should know." And Mom would be depressed all day. And she spent a lot of her life depressed because she kept track of the reasons to be. I can remember after my father was murdered, I was walking into a meeting, and I was feeling good. I was having a good day, and I was walking in. I was smiling, walking in, hi. And over here I heard somebody say, "Oh, that's Ed Mutum. His dad was killed in the Shamrock." As soon as I heard it, you know what I did? I'm above that, aren't I? No. Little attention getter. Pour me a drink. I used my father's death for attention. I used my father's death to be the victim and continued to be the victim. One of the things I found out is that I could no longer allow me to do that kind of stuff. And we'll get into grieving hopefully a little later in 6 and 7 because I was an excellent griever. And God forbid I had a legitimate reason to grieve. Sober, I'd run it to the hilt. Had a little friend of mine. I met her about 2 years ago. She's doing well today. She was a number of years sober and got on a lot of meds that weren't serving her well. When I met her, she was at a conference in really wanting to die. And I said, "Would you trust me enough? Ask your sponsor if it's okay if you and I go through the steps. Would you trust me enough to do that and see if we can't get you feeling better?" And she, thank God, she said yes, because I've been there. She could have just as easily killed herself. It would have been easier, in fact, the way it looks from that point. The reason I tell you that is this last Christmas, on the 20th of December, her brother, who was sober, got killed in a car wreck at 24 years old. If she hadn't done what she'd been doing, she hadn't done the work and the step work she'd been doing, that would have destroyed her. And she came through that and was a good daughter, and was a good sister, and went through the emotions that you go through when you lose somebody you love, kept her dignity intact. And she shares in meetings that this works. It really does. It's important what we find out in 4 and 5. It's important information. And if you didn't get the information you think you need, do it again. Do it again. I don't mean obsessively. I don't mean take an inventory every day. If you're doing that, you need life is what you need. But what I mean is go back. Because, see, a lot of times when I talk, people come up and I remember one guy said, just walked up to me after one session, "Why would you leave me alone?" I said, "There's 200 other people here, guy. It wasn't about you." But I understand the feeling. I understand the feeling. See, my job is to stir it up. That's what my job is. When I come in, I say, "God, let me stir it up. Not to be right, not to be wrong. Just stir it up and you talk to your kids the way you need to talk to them." That's why I don't use notes anymore. I used to use notes and I used to go... But one day I was going through my notes and God talked to me. He said, "Ed, I appreciate the notes, but what if there's somebody in there I need to talk to?" and you're sticking with your notes. I got a feeling Bob didn't bring notes when he went to the gatehouse, or Bill didn't. Bob didn't either, probably, but he didn't bring notes. He let the conversation take place. And so that's the way I do it, and that's why sometimes I lose track. But I really believe I ask God to anoint me and to share with me what somebody needs to hear. So if it comes up and if it comes to mind, that's why I share it. Not that I'm trying to be cute or anything else. I'm just trying to be a servant because that's my job today. That's all I want to be. I want to be at the door, letting people in and letting people out, not going too far in, not going too far out. But I want to make sure that door is open for our kids and our grandkids. That's most important to me, that they have the gift we've been given. So when I'm doing 4 and 5, I really need to make sure that something's happening. If something isn't happening, I need to reapproach it. And there's a lot of ways to do that. Step 6, well, we can talk about the grieving now. There we go. I always get them crossways. I always say step 6 instead of 5. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. One of my greatest defects of character was grieving. It kept it all about me. I travel a lot, and I go a lot of places. Interesting, a lot of times, from time to time, I walk up and I haven't seen somebody in 3 or 4 years, and I say, "How are you?" And they say, "Well, you know, 3 years ago I got divorced, and 2 years ago I lost my job, and this last year the kid's in trouble." I said, "Oh, how are you? Why are you keeping track of that? What's that got to do with today?" "Everything. Because that's how my life is." How do I know that? If you spot it, you got it. If you spot it, you got it. I would use every bad thing that ever happened to me as a tool for... Had a guy walk into me and talk to me about 3 years ago, and walked into my office and said, "Ed, can I talk to you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "It was on a Monday." And I said, "Sure, what do you need to talk about?" He said, "Well, I'm just going to be real depressed Friday." And I thought, well, at least he's planning them. That's, you know, progress, I guess, you know. Yeah. Wish I could have planned them. They kind of crept up on me, but... I said, "Why is that?" And he got real sullen, and he said, "It's the anniversary of my daughter's death." I said, "Oh." And it had been a few years since she died. He said, "I just don't know what to do." And I got prayerful, and I said, "Why don't you do this? Thursday night, right before you go to bed, get your favorite picture of your daughter. Put it right beside your bed. In the morning when you wake up, you look at that picture and you thank God for every moment you had with her. And you lift her memory and you celebrate those ringlets and that every butterfly kiss and every tickle giggle and every hug. And all day long, you just lift her up and lift her memory up." I said, "Or you can make it all about you." He made a request of me that's physically impossible and left. I understand that. He had a good month in 12-step programs going and making it all about him. Making it all about him. Why do we do that? There's a story I love. If you're a Christian, you'll get it, but hopefully it's meaningful to everybody. I think you'll have a basic understanding of it. I watched this happen. A guy was having a terrible problem with grieving his son's death, and for 3 years he had sobbed every day. I mean, this guy's heart was broken, and he said, "I really need some help with this. I can't breathe." That's where I was. I was talking about deep breathing, Clint Hodges. Thanks. We'll try to catch it later. But he couldn't breathe, and he went to see this guy, and the guy's a wonderful guy. He said, "What, do you have a faith?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "What's your faith?" And he said, "I'm a Christian." And he said, "Okay." He said, "I want to do some visualization with you. I want you to close your eyes for a minute. Just close your eyes." And he closed his eyes, and he said, "I want you to envision the gates of St. Peter." He said, can you see the gates of heaven, the gates of St. Peter? He said, yeah, I can see that. And he said, I want you to see St. Peter outside with a beautiful candle. And there's an aura all around St. Peter, and he's got this candle. And there's a row of thousands of people with white robes in front. And people come up, and they lean in, and they light that candle, and when it comes back, they're illuminated. And they're restored, and they're whole, and they walk into heaven. He said, can you see that? He said, yeah, I can see that. He said, okay, I want you to look over to the left there, and there's a little bench there with your son sitting on it. He said, do you see that? And the guy got visibly shaken. He said, yeah, I see that. He said, notice in his hand he's got a candle that's unlit. He said, can you see that? And he said, yes, I can see that. He said, with your permission, I want you to ask your son why he's sitting there, and with your permission, I will answer for your son. He said, okay. He said, ask your son. He said, son, why are you sitting there? And the man answered back, Daddy, every time I go through, your tears drowned out my candle. I can't go through. And it was just the best visionary I've ever seen of lifting their memory. If you're going to believe about spirit, if you're going to believe about energy, lift them up. Don't pull them down. You want to give them a gift, give them a celebration. My mother died of cancer. Do you know what day she died? Neither do I, because I celebrate my mother's memory. I celebrate the way she lived. All the goodness in it. I don't make it about me. I don't go to the cemetery. That helps a lot of people. For me, it's just a reminder of a very bad day. But to me anymore, it's a good day. And it's funny how that works. About 3 months ago, I got a call, and a 15-year-old boy had been thrown out of an SUV in a little town north of Davenport, and it killed him. Well, I was his parents' pastor 12 or 13 years ago, and his name's Ertzie. Ertzie was my first baptism as a pastor, and I baptized Ertzie, and he gave me a high five. Yeah. Perfect for me, you know, perfect for me. And for some reason, they called me, and they said, Ertzie got killed today. Would you come out and do the funeral? And I said, well, gather the family together, and let's have a conversation. And I went out, and we had the conversation, and my conversation's pretty much the same. Now, if you want to make this all about crying and grieving, you're more than welcome to do that, but I won't be a part. I do not want the day Ertzie died to be remembered about how he lived. This kid was amazing. He had friends everywhere. They had the Gang of Grand Mound. Now, the Gang of Grand Mound has 400 people, so you can imagine the Gang of Grand Mound. And they all ran around together, and this gang mowed lawns. They were a tough gang, you know. And the young man that was driving the vehicle, Easton, was sitting there. And we were at the funeral home, and I said, Easton, come here a minute. I said, how you doing? He went, okay. I said, you know, you got a lot of work ahead of you. And he said, why is that? And I said, I hear Ertzie was a pretty happy, joyful guy. And I hear that same about you. And he really lifted people's lives up. And he said, well, yeah. And I said, you know, as a result of this accident, you get to be Ertzie's joy too. And you get to live. He says, is it okay to do that? I said, I promise you it is. I promise you it is. Every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock in Davenport, Iowa, I look out and I see the Grand Mound Gang sitting there, closer to God than they've ever been. Because you see, I taught them about a God I learned about in AA that doesn't take the people I love, but he welcomes them. It's a big difference. God's never ripped anybody out of my life. People have, situations have, difficulties have, but not God. So when we talk about defects of character, when we talk about that, we got to talk about something that I was unfamiliar with. We'll talk about it more in step 7. But it's humility. Humility. Humility is acknowledging the gifts God gave you and quit arguing about them. That's humility. Strange take, isn't it? Humility is counting our joys. Humility is looking for what we've been given, not what we've been left. And with character defects, I do the same thing with them. I told you I'd mention it a lot, and it's surrender. I don't work on step six. When one of those come up, I surrender it and get out of the way. I don't play with it. I don't ask why it came to mind. I don't give myself the quiz so I can feel bad because another shortcoming and character defect I have is beating myself up because I'm not perfect. How unfair. How unkind. How unjust. It's a form of child abuse. You're a child of God. Stop abusing yourself. Who gave you that right? You didn't create you. Who are you to judge you? You're a child of God. You have the right to be here. One of the challenges I give a lot of people is, I gave to somebody already here. I want you to start treating yourself as if you actually like you. What an order. I can't go through with it. I want you to start treating yourself as if you actually like you. Now, this isn't to build your self-esteem. This is to acknowledge that, how would you treat a child of God? Well, guess who you are, whether you like it or not. And some people can't make with that. I say, okay, is there somebody you really love and respect and admire? I say, yeah. How would you treat them if they made the same mistake you just made? What would you tell them? And if they're active people, I'd say, what would you tell one of the girls you're working with? Or if it's an active guy, I say, what would you... And they give excellent advice. And I say, now follow your own advice. Take us that self-centeredness out of the equation and give us the right to breathe deeply. I was talking about being a shallow breather. That's when I got off thinking about Clint. Clint was talking one time, and he said it as a throwaway line. He said, when I was 9 years old, I stopped deep breathing. I thought, why would he say that? And I was prayerful about it, and I realized I'd always been a shallow breather. And most alcoholics I talk to, and most people who love alcoholics, are shallow breathers too. That's why it doesn't take much for us to get upset or uptight. So one of the things I do is I take a deep breath every time I consciously think about it. In through the nose and out through the mouth. Why? What does your body run on? Oxygen. If you know anything about mechanics, if you don't have the mix right, how's your car going to run? It ain't. It's going to go, you know. So one of my defects was not taking the time to breathe in life, literally. So I take the time to do that. I take the time to breathe in the healing, loving power of God and exhale the loving, healing power of God. Now, you've heard that in 10,000 ways. Count to 10. Breathe deeply. Not rapidly, you're hyperventilate, but breathe deeply and slowly and breathe the breath of life. Because that's one of the ways I enjoy it today. I was so proud of Joyce yesterday. We were in that accident and they give us a pretty good whack. And she handled herself remarkably well. She was very calm. And she still doesn't know how to accept a compliment, but I'll share that with you in a minute about how I learned that. But she did incredibly well. And the thing I noticed is she didn't hyperventilate. She didn't do anything. She hadn't been in an accident in a long, long time. She didn't know anything about it. She took her time. She said, well, I haven't done this in a while. What are you supposed to do? And I said, you need your license and insurance. And she went and took care of all that. Calm. And I said to her, I said, you did a remarkable. She said, oh, I was jello inside. I said, that don't count. Remember what I said about courage last night? And if you weren't here, courage and faith. A lot of people say courage is Fred shot out there. I'm going to go out and get Fred. Run on out there. And courage is Fred shot out there. I'm scared to death, but I'm going to go try to help my friend. That's courage. Faith isn't, well, I believe in everything is possible, and this doesn't bother me at all. No, faith is, ooh, I'm scared to death, but I'm going to go anyway, believing it might work. That's faith. And she acted on her faith, and she did a remarkable job. Another defect I had was I had the inability to say thank you. Clancy walked up to me one time, and I was broke. And he shook my hand, and he had $5 in it. And as he walked away, I saw the $5. This was back in 72, where $5 was some money. That would get you, if I remember, a loaf of bread, a quart of milk, and a pound of bologna. But he started walking away, and I looked at $5. I said, oh, excuse me, I can't take this $5. I can't take this $5. And if you know Clancy, in his kind and loving way, walked up to me and said, shut up! Why don't you just shut up, you big dummy? Why has it always got to be about you? Why don't you just say thank you? Why do you got to destroy the spirit of the giver? You have no idea why I gave you that money. Just shut up and say thank you. I said, well, nobody ever explained it to me like that before. Told you last night I left the big church and started my own little deal there, and that's hard to do. When one of the reasons they have big churches, they got money to help each other, and that's helpful. And a gal come down to see me in my office one day, and she said, Ed, if God told you to do something, would you do it? And I said, oh, absolutely. She said, would you do it halfway? And I said, no, I'll do it all the way. If I know God, if that it's clear that God told me to do it, I'm doing it. She said, oh, okay, there's a check on your desk for $500. God told me to give you $1,000. I'm going to go home and get the other check. I said, thank you. What she didn't know is all the utilities were due that day. $998.70. I simply said, thank you. 2 weeks later, she came up to me and said, Ed, I really want to thank you. And I said, for what? She said, you just said thank you. I've always been a giver, and people make it so difficult. It's what I'm here to do. What lessons? International Convention, Toronto. I had planned to go, and things were going well, and all of a sudden, financially, again, doing your own thing, things can get pretty tight. And I had some money, but that money had to go to bills, and doggone it, you guys taught me where I had to put the money where it belonged. Not to my next urge. I think a flat-screen TV is what God wants me to have right here. Not that any of you'd ever do that, but... So I called a friend of mine who was going to meet me up in Canada, and I said, you know what, I'm not going to be able to make it. I'd already had that, paid the registration, and I had my flight. We were staying in a real nice hotel, and it was expensive, and I said, I'm just not going to be able to make it. I can't do that without taking money that isn't mine to take, and I said, I won't do that. And he said, oh, okay, well, we'll miss you. He called me back an hour later, and he said, Ed, do you remember when we met? I said, yeah, it was up in Banff, wasn't it? He said, yeah. God, Banff's beautiful. You ever get a chance to go? He said, you remember we were walking through that root store? And I said, yeah. He said, you remember I saw a pair of boots that I really liked? He said, things were a bit tight for me, so I looked at them and I put them down. And I said, yeah. He said, when we got to the checkout, you had those boots. And you paid the person for them, and you handed them to me. And I said, oh, I can't. And you said, shut up. Just say thank you. Don't destroy the spirit of the giver. He said, do you remember that? And I said, well, yeah. He said, I'm picking up your hotel tab in Canada. Remember what you preach. And I just said, thank you. You see, one of the things when we give up those defects, I believe graces follow. I believe that allows the grace to come in when we get out of that realm of being a defect. I hear people all the time say, well, you know, there's some defects I like, and I just give those people plenty of room and don't allow my kids around them. I'm dead serious. Now, if they were a pedophile and said that they were sober and work in program, and work in the steps, because I have walked several sex... Oh, there's one, judgment. They used to say, whatever you hate, you are. And people bothering kids at all really bothered me, and I hated that, and I knew that I had no problem there. So that never made sense to me. I'm out in Los Angeles, and I have this guy's permission to share this. There was a guy named Lance Rensel. He was a wide receiver for the Los Angeles Rams. Nice guy. He was married to an actress named Joey Heatherton in California. And Lance had a problem exposing himself to children. He got arrested for that, and boy, and everybody kind of looked the other way because this guy was such an exceptional talent. And 6 months later, he did the exact same thing. Lost his wife, lost his career. Community service was part of his penance, if you will. And I go down to the Midnight Mission one time, and there's Lance doing community service. And Clancy said, Ed, I'd like you to meet Lance Rensel. Lance, this is Ed Mutum. Ed's a recovering alcoholic. Oh, hi, hi, hi. Clancy walked out. He said, Lance said to me, well, I have a problem exposing myself to children. I said, you know, I really don't know a lot about that. And he said, oh, I thought you said you were alcoholic. And I said, yeah. He said, yeah, you have no idea about having a compulsion to do something. And if you do it, it'll cost you everything you've ever loved, and you do it anyway. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you? And I said, I'm sorry. See, I have the same capabilities, just a different area. Now, that's not saying that's okay. But I've met a lot of people with that approach who no longer offend one day at a time and no longer have the urge one day at a time. I'm so grateful for that lesson. And it's another lesson. Don't be so quick to judge. Oh, man, we're over on time again. Okay, the Ask It Basket. We'll take a couple of those, and then we'll break. We'll be a few minutes late. It's right there? Okay. Are there any others to go in? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Oh, boy, this is a good question. I'm going to make some people annoyed, probably, but faith, true faith, overcomes fear, compulsion, phony aspirations. Why so much depression in AA? Because it's encouraged. That's why. Bill Wilson was a terrible depressive. That after 10 years of fighting depression, finally got doing what he wrote about, what we're talking about, and no longer had depressions. Depression is a way of life today. It's a billion-dollar industry, and people like us are just lambs being led to the slaughter because there's well-meaning people that have no idea about addiction. They want to treat it. Depression... look in the big book, see how many times depression's mentioned in there. Again, that emotional sobriety pamphlet I gave you. It's an article Bill wrote, and the title of it says he wrote to a fellow depressive. Depression isn't new, especially for addicted people. I was termed manic depressive and that I could never live without some sort of medication. I haven't had a good one. In 25 years. And I used to get the good ones. I used to get the ones where covers over the head and you wouldn't see me for days and I'd try to starve myself or I'd just wish I'd die. And it wasn't a casual thought. But true faith does overcome it. But the 12 steps are the way to build the faith. But if you don't do the directions, you can't have the faith. See, that's one of the things I love about the 12 steps. And I have a lot of pastors come to me and talk with me about... When I took this big, I was pointed to this big church, and this guy really worked to get me there. And he came in, I was there the second day, and he said, Ed, he said, I'm so delighted to have you here with church with us. He said, I've been in the ministry for 30 years, and I know all the ins and outs of the Methodist system, and I'm so glad you're here. He said, I've got one favor to ask you. And I said, what's that? He said, teach me about God. And it was one of the most humbling moments in my life.